Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Stephen M. Walt from Harvard and the Israel Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy. And also Dan Johnson from People Against the NDAA. An interview arranged by our good friend Haji. Boy, we sure miss you in the chat room, Haji. Stephen Walt's going to be on to talk about the possibility of a nuclear deal with the Iranians. A real possibility? Question mark, exclamation point, in parentheses? Man. It'd be nice if I got my way just sometimes, ever. I would like it. Just this once. And then, yeah, People Against the NDAA. You get that. Well, I guess NDAA is not necessarily self-explanatory. That's the National Defense Authorization Act. They spend about $700 billion a year on the military. And really, it's about $1 trillion. That's what goes directly to the Pentagon. But then you have the Department of Energy, and you have the Homeland Security, and the CIA, and all the different intelligence agencies. And then the wars mostly are kept off book. Depends on which wars and which occupations you're talking about. But usually they'll have separate appropriations for that. It's approximately $1 trillion a year that they spend. But anyway, the NDAA every year is about $700 billion. And what's most controversial about it, it's not that. No. Mass murdering? Holding a whole world hostage. That's not really a big issue. But there's one little provision in the NDAA of 2012 and 13, which says they can turn us all into Jose Padilla, basically. Being an American citizen arrested on American soil will no longer protect you from military detention. Oh, but the signing statement says Obama promises never to do that to you. Like every Democrat's hero, FDR. But then again, as Glenn Greenwald documented quite thoroughly on his blog, I believe at Salon.com at the time. Yeah. Would have been still when he was writing at Salon. Obama was the one who pushed to make sure that the language that included you and your little sister was still in there. They could have very easily crafted the language to very specifically and very definitively exclude Americans. And that should be all U.S. persons, not just American citizens. That's any American citizen anywhere in the world, and also anyone inside the United States, unless they're an agent of a foreign power. So, well, in fact, even if they're agent of foreign powers, still get, should be fair trial, fair detention. Just maybe you could get expelled from the country, or get your phone tapped on a lower threshold. But anyway, just because, you know, that would be the accusation, right? That Jose Padilla was agent of a foreign power, which maybe he was, but assigned to do what? A lot of nothing? Huh. But anyway, yeah, the military and the CIA, they tortured Padilla for years in a brig in South Carolina. An American citizen, born on American soil, arrested on American soil by civilian domestic police in windbreakers. But then turned over to the military and the CIA. This is the no-touch torture, Nazi style. Hey, not a bruise on him. All we did was give him a bunch of psychotropic drugs and sensory deprivation and deliberately drove him mad. Anyway, So that's a really big deal. And you know what? I think, I don't know if people can get enthused by our recent victory on the Syria issue to imagine that, you know what, maybe we, that is, the civilians of America, can insist that our government be rolled back here, there, and another place too. Here's a good place to roll back their power. How about their claimed authority to have U.S. persons held by the military? Let's get rid of that. The worst law they've passed recently. And then, you know what? Maybe we can build on these achievements. I think the Syria thing is huge. I mean, you heard me. I'm mean and cynical, and I figure conservatives only oppose the war because they hate Obama so much, and liberals only oppose the war this time because I don't know what. Maybe they're really scared of what might happen if they got involved in Libya, unlike Syria, or, pardon me, strike that, reverse it. In Syria, unlike Libya, which I think it was pretty obvious from the get-go, or it seemed at least from the get-go, that it was going to be done on the Bill Clinton-style cheap from the air with missiles and airstrikes rather than a big war, and they still during their honeymoon phase. But you know what? From the very first day I ever did radio, in 1998 on Free Radio Austin, the show was mostly about Waco. Because I thought, man, I want to talk about Waco. But here's the thing of it. I had a whole rant about how the best parts of the left and the best parts of the right agree on the empire. And they agree on the Bill of Rights. That is, they want it. And the best parts of the right only want to conserve the best parts of liberalism on the left. That's all. And so I know that I'm the plumb line, and I'm a cynical jerk also, so that means, from my own point of view, everybody to the right of me is a Nazi and everybody to the left a communist, but not really. You know, that's just because I'm purely perfect on everything. You guys are all a bunch of horrible deviationists. But still, I can, you know, I can put aside the hyperbole for a minute. There's a lot of room to compromise with good liberals, progressive, leftist, socialist, communist, left, the most generally defined. Anyone who's on the left could be included in a real realignment for peace and liberty. And really, that's true on the right as well. I mean, the neoconservatives, they're really the centrists. You can't really call them right-wingers. But if you take a real right-winger, there is that, what I don't consider this a slander, I think it's beautiful. There is that isolationist sentiment among right-wingers. That, you know what? Actually, now that a Democrat's up there in the chair and the my fever pitch from all my slogan shouting has died down a little bit, I'm kind of thinking that, you know what? Maybe invading every other country in the world and making them do right and whatever is a bridge too far. Maybe, you know, we should just mind our own business. Now, there are a lot of Americans who live their whole life just in one county. Certainly in one state. And all they care about is their church, their spouse, their children, their aunts and uncles and cousins, their friends down at the social meeting place where they meet. That's why they're here, because their grandparents fled from Poland or wherever, China, so they could come and have a nice life and leave the world alone and not have to be concerned about it, not have to take responsibility for what their government is doing to it. Yeah, let's conserve that. Let's conserve leaving the world alone. Let's realign. I mean, after all, what does a labor union and a homosexual group have to do with each other whatsoever? Why are those two things on the left? They're just in a coalition party together. But otherwise, their interests don't necessarily coincide, and I just picked two things out of a hat. Maybe I could have done a better job picking interest groups on the left that are actually directly opposed to each other or whatever. But anyway, if you put aside all this, you know, who created the earth and all this stuff, people want to, you know, abortion and whatever cultural issues people want to fight about, whose country and whose rock and roll, as they put it on South Park. And you just want to focus on the actual issues. About approximately half the left is good on peace and the Bill of Rights. And approximately, yeah, with deviations on the Second Amendment, etc., I know. And on the right, about half of them are good on peace and on the Bill of Rights. I mean, and again, it waxes and wanes depending on who's in power, who can be bothered to oppose their dear leader, whether it's Bush or Obama or Clinton or other Bush or whoever. You know, so realign. On the extremist center, we have Barack Obama, the conservative Democrat, and John McCain, the liberal Republican, the centrist extremists who want to go to war with everyone, who want to wage a war on everything, who despise the Constitution and any precept that limitations on their power to do what they wilt with the rest of us. And then there's the real moderate center, the libertarians. Now, we're radicals and everything, and we really mean it. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean moderate like wishy-washy, but I mean moderate like we are, as a matter of principle, against doing extreme things to everyone all the time. We're just extremely interested in stopping doing all those extreme things. So we're the real moderates. The libertarians, we're the real moderate center, and around us, I like to see it does happen. We can rally the good conservatives who want to conserve the good kind of liberalism. It's like in my speech that I gave at the Ron Paul thing back a year ago, was I want to see, and maybe this is a better way to illustrate my point without going on and on and on. What if we had a real two-party system where we had the Democratic Republicans on one side, and that was the party of the civilian people of America, the regular just people. And then the other party could be the war party. And that would be the party of the bankers and the arms dealers and the agribusiness firms and the hospital companies, the pill pushers and the insurance companies and the old people lobby. And they would be the party of taxation and theft and torture and murder and dishonesty and terrible bookkeeping. We could call them the Federalists. And we'll be the Democratic Republicans. And then it'll be obvious who's who. It'll be the 1% versus the 99%. And I know abortion is an important issue to people who hold it as a very important issue. I couldn't ever talk you out of that, I guess. But even if that is your single issue, you gotta see how those with the real power use it as a bludgeon to keep you divided from your neighbor who you have every other thing in common with. You know, I heard a liberal complaining about whenever anyone poor or just, you know, a thousandaire or whatever, a middle-class person complains about the rich, that's class warfare. But whatever the rich use the state to do to the rest of us, that's not, for some reason. Well, I don't really go with that. I've got that classical liberal class analysis. Not that it's the most sophisticated one, but... And ultimately, you know, it is those who would use the political means of getting by versus those who would use the economic means. And really, welfare is wrong. All welfare is stealing at the end of the day. But geez, who are you most angry at? Paraplegic, you know, who's got nothing and is just trying to make it? Collecting some food stamps and some Section 8 housing? Or Lockheed? Where they're all just the biggest, fattest welfare whores in the history of the world. They just do nothing but binge on the world's deepest honeypot. and just laughing about it, right? Just, you know, considering any kind of morality or accountability, ridiculous farce. Can't touch them. It seems to me like we should abolish food stamps because we should abolish the entire government. And then, so who's going to pass them out? Somebody else. Anyway. It just seems like we should get rid of the most evil things our government does first. You know, like imprison people without trial. Or imprison people with, you know, bogus trials. Or just stack so many charges against them that they have to plea bargain to things that they didn't really do. Or waging world empire against the rest of the people on the planet. You know, killing them with high explosives and stuff like that. Threatening to change their regimes. Holding hydrogen bombs over their heads. You know, I don't know. You don't have to have that much imagination to figure out that, hey, it doesn't have to be like this. Oh, gee, the very worst people in America have complete control over the state and the rest of us are screwed. I wonder if that's why everything is messed up. Now, I read an article in The Guardian yesterday that said that there's no population crisis. Whenever you hear people say, oh, no, there's too many people, it's time to start culling them, they're just crazy. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't know nothing about economics. And look at how many more people there are now than there were back 100 years ago when culling the population was all the rage. When people were especially sure about their Malthusian economic policies, theories, and policies. Why are there so many poor and homeless people? Well, there's just too many damn people, I guess. Because I don't have any better ideas. Well, it turned out, as this guy puts it in the article, I think quite correctly, no, the government was parceling out, was, you know, it was the law that a parcel of land could only be so small. In other words, only people who were already big land barons could afford to own and trade in land. And once they liberalized those policies and land was legal to sell off in smaller parcels, problem solved. You just have to include more people on the rights, their natural right to own and trade with who they feel like. But then what's his conclusion? He says, look at America where 30% of the corn is spent on fuel and fake sugar. Are you kidding me? This is not a policy of there's not enough arable land in the world. This is a matter of bad policy about how that arable land is used. But then what's his excuse? What's his diagnosis and prognosis at the end? In this Guardian article, you can find it on my Facebook page. He says, so what we need to do is have the government nationalize all the farmland. You know, because then it'll be great, because then we'll use our democratic processes to decide the perfect thing to do with it all. Right? He says, the problem now is fascism. What's the solution? Communism. Right now, Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland own Congress, and Congress uses their violence to determine exactly how these resources are to be divvied up, to set the prices, in effect, for their corrupt crony interests. What's the solution? Oh, we should all just starve to death, I guess. Right? Don't stop for 1 second and ask, what government policies were there that ended up handing every family farm in America over to Archer Daniels Midland Company? And God help me, I don't know the rest of them, but there are a lot of others that are just as horrible. What happened? Geez, could it have anything to do with the manipulation of the interest rates? With the boom and the bust and the luring of regular folks deep into debt and then jacking interest rates up through the roof, bankrupting them all? This is part of, you know, all the scholarship about the militia movement of the 90s. Talks about how these guys were all the guys who got their farms stolen in the 80s. You know? Ah, shit. I'm over time. Oops. Oh, shoot. I'm over time. Here's a commercial. FFF.org/subscribe. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Aw, man, I could have swore I changed the music to Tuesday's music. That's okay, I played Tuesday's music all week last week. I'll play Monday's music again here. I actually don't care if you hate the bumper music. I like it. All right. So I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I don't make for a very good leader of the realignment movement because I'm just too cynical and jaded and angry at this point. Have a lot of trouble believing in anything at all. But you know what? It is undeniable that people at least believe that the legacy of America is liberty and justice for all. So, you know, if we can tap into that and sort of insist upon it kind of a thing, then maybe we could get a little, you know? I'll tell you an example that impressed me, at least the way I learned it when I was a little kid, was, and you know, we just had the anniversary recently and everything, but it was Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And yeah, I have a dream, this and that, that everything will be fine, this and that, but what really changed the world was he challenged white Americans whether they really believed in the number one slogan of the USA or not. The number one slogan. What makes us so exceptional is that we believe that everybody's an individual and they're all born with natural rights. They should all be judged accordingly. So now either you believe that or you don't. So which is it? And I'm not saying, you know, it's everything's perfect now, or something silly, but just, this was at least the way I learned it from my liberal white parents when I was a kid, is that this was the watershed. Finally, white Americans, in their supermajority, had been called completely out on their BS, and they had to admit it, that they had been wrong, and it was time to start being righter now. And you know, it just made it, that was the real beginning of the end of bigotry and polite company. You know what? That's not cool, man. Even if everybody in the room is white, somebody there is going, oh, I can't believe you said that. All right, the beginning of real PC. And, you know, compared to lynchings all the time, it's a steady improvement. You know, you always gotta measure historical context. But anyway, the point being, I guess if the right person at the right time and place and in the right cadence calls the American people out, that what they've been doing is wrong and that they ought to start acting right, it can be done, right? I don't know. I try to tell myself these things too. I mentioned to you a few weeks ago, I think, that Winston Churchill quote, I don't know, I'm paraphrasing it anyway, something about how the American people will always do the right thing eventually after they've exhausted every other possibility. And of course what he means is they'll fight our war for us again. That was what he meant in context, but anyway. I still like the quote that, yeah, we'll do, you know, it'll be like pulling teeth. It'll be the most difficult thing imaginable to get it to happen, but yeah, eventually the American people will straighten up and fly right and do the right thing. So it seems like we could have a political realignment where, you know, the Justin Amashes of the right and the, I don't know who's good on the left, few of them good congressmen on the left, get it together and stop being quite as murderous and criminal. I'm not saying that's the end of all American activism or anything. I'm just saying it is something attainable, I think, within the realm of possibility. I agree with Ernie Hancock, who interviewed me this morning, that what we really need to do, what people who care about peace and freedom really need to do, is just stop being the demand for their supply. Oh, government? No, please go and jump in a lake. I don't want your help. I don't want your security services. I don't want nothing. Like that Onion article, libertarian reluctantly calls fire department. Oh, man, I tried hard to put it out myself, but I just couldn't do it. Still, though, the fire department could be much better in private service. Exactly. That's how we need to be. Need to just go around them as much as we can. And stop asking them to do us favors. You know, Anthony Gregory pointed out on the show years ago that really the whole terror war, all the American people really asked George Bush to do was find the guys who were responsible for September 11th and kill them. But you give them an inch and they'll take a million miles. That was the mandate. The mandate from the American people was really not kill them all. It was twisted into that, and they were made to, you know, George Bush kept telling them, yeah, you can continue indulging your bloodlust. Come with me to Iraq. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But they would have settled for carpet bomb in Afghanistan for a couple of weeks, and that would have been it, you know? Didn't have to let bin Laden and Zawahiri go at Tora Bora, but, you know, that's why Tommy Franks has so many medals. But you can't give them permission to do anything. You can't ask them to do anything, or they will do whatever they want. So, hate them. You know, I mean, that's really what I'm doing here. I'm attempting to delegitimize the state, because it ain't legit. They do nothing but prove that all day long. For example, I watched a very small portion of the president's speech to the United Nations this morning, and when I hit unmute on him talking there, the first thing he said was how America supported the people of Egypt in the Arab Spring. Are you kidding me? He's lucky they didn't pan out and show the General Assembly sitting there listening to this. America was on the side of the protesters there, huh? Oh, except for when they weren't the whole time up until the bitter end. When Mubarak realized he better flee before he got killed. And then, just a few weeks ago, July, when America's military, the dictatorship of Egypt, overthrew the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood, they'd already canceled their parliament long ago, overthrew their president, massacred approximately 1,500-something people in the streets, and reinstalled the dictatorship, which Obama didn't say a thing about, other than let's find a way to break the law and continue selling them weapons and giving them money anyway. Job well done, guys. Seems kind of dishonest to me, you know? Mm. All right. So I got a bunch of news and Stephen Walt and Dan Johnson coming up on the show, so hang around. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Ow, bit my tongue. I do that from time to time. It's sort of like if you smoke cigarettes with a white filter. Every once in a while, you're going to light it backwards kind of thing. It's just a matter of probabilities, you know? At some point, you light the damn thing backwards. Well, I do nothing but talk all the time, and so from time to time, I bite my tongue. Never figuratively, but pretty often literally, actually. Yeah, anyway. All right, well, so yeah, I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, and I did an interview on Ernie Hancock's show, as I was mentioning there, this morning, and he gave me a chance. He asked me real general, what's going on there with this whole Kenya Somalia thing? So I started out joking about how, yeah, TV says history began in 2006, and I guess we're lucky that they're not just sticking with history began yesterday. But of course, history began back in the 1980s, at least, when it comes to America and Somalia. And then, you know, clock ticking, I think I pretty much nailed the history of America messing with Somalia in, you know, one kind of 5 or 6 minute little rant there. And then, of course, he had his follow-up questions and stuff. But, and then, you know, of course, ended it with the famine and the part that America's war played in making it so much worse, the drought, turning the drought into a famine, really. And, yeah, that was probably the best little 5 minutes on Somalia I've ever done. If anybody wants to listen to that, I think he keeps the archives there at freedomsphoenix.com. Maybe I'll, you know, he makes YouTube videos out of every interview too, so maybe I'll post that up on my Facebook page or over at scotthorton.org. By the way, it's the new and improved scotthorton.org, and I gotta get back in the habit of hanging around over there and writing my blog entries there at Stress instead of over on Facebook, basically, which is what I'm doing. But I gotta get all my addresses straight, and I gotta get all my RSS feeds straight, and I gotta get the plugins lined up correctly to automatically push the blog entries out to Facebook and Twitter and whatever. But anyway, we're getting it together. So the new and improved scotthorton.org. There's a chat room built in, which I should be in the chat room right now, but I forgot to log in. It's scotthorton.org/chat. And, yeah, man, you know, back in 2007, 8, 9, maybe 2006, 7, 8, something. Yeah, no, because, let's see, when did I make Stress? I guess the end of 05 is when I made Stress. Something like that. So, yeah, back then, 06, 07, 08, around there, that's a happening place, man. The Stress blog. So I'm going to try to make it that way again. I've written a couple of things. I really have gotten lazy. I noticed how lazy I was when I was slapping together this blog entry about what a damned liar David Sanger is. David Sanger, he's a so-called, quote-unquote, reporter at the New York Times, although I think probably he's an agent of a foreign power and off to Guantanamo with him for it. He's here representing Israel. In the pages of the New York Times, always, just for years on end, pretending the Iranians are making nuclear weapons when everyone knows that they're not and that he's a liar. And then he just keeps writing it. The other day he had one where he said that if you have a big enough pile of 20% enriched uranium, it's a matter of just a couple of weeks and turning a couple of screws before you're able to turn that 20% enriched uranium-235 into a nuclear bomb. Uh-huh.
like on the Seinfeld show. Pile of uranium, yada, 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 nuclear bomb. Yeah, just don't give me any details, David, or they'll put the lie to your conclusion within a couple of weeks. What a liar. My God, that's hardly enough time to start a war against them, huh, David? Maybe we should start bombing them now. Is that what you recommend? And you know, David Sanger, he's admitted before on the Charlie Rose Show what his bias is and what his conclusions are and why his journalism is so crappy. It's because he's got a vendetta against Iran. And he believes, without any evidence whatsoever, that their nuclear program is cover for an illicit nuclear weapons program. He claims to believe that. I don't know why anyone would take him seriously when he claims to believe something any more than they take him seriously when he claims any other fact. It would be a fact whether or not he believes something or not, right? I don't take his word for anything. The guy's a joke. But anyway, I just put 10 times more effort into saying all that than I put into writing up my little blog entry about what a despicable piece of crap he is, just because I don't know why. Just, man, I don't know why writing is such a pain for me. It takes a little bit longer. I just got the ADD. That's what it is, man. And I don't want any pills. I just can't sit still long enough to write anything anymore, I guess. David Sanger. You know what would be fun would be to see whether anyone has ever gone through the New York Times archives and found every instance where David Sanger referred as a fact, without proving it, of course, to Iran's nuclear weapons program. Now, you'd have to do more than just search nytimes.com for Sanger and, quote, nuclear weapons program. Because that could include parts, you know, places where he's paraphrasing someone else or quoting someone else or something like that. So in the context, you'd have to be more careful than that. The context would have to be David Sanger pretending like he knows it's a fact that they've got a nuclear weapons program and just simply asserting it in his paragraph. I bet you can find dozens and dozens and dozens, maybe more than 100. I bet you it wouldn't be hard at all. I bet you'd be amazed to see how many times the New York Times lead writer on Iran's nuclear program and related issues has so terribly and so dishonestly reported on the progress of their program there. I mean, it really is. I mean, not like you wouldn't already be born suspicious of the New York Times. Yeah, they've got agendas and none of them are good. So, of course, yeah, you know. But I'm just saying, still, it's kind of jaw-dropping. It's kind of incredible. You know, they'll throw somebody like Jason Blair under the bus because he lied about whether or not he took a plane to Florida to get a quote, right? Some little thing like that. Puts a false byline. Byline Nashville, when really he's at a bar in New York on the phone to Nashville or something like that. Big deal. David Sanger, Michael Gordon, those guys can sit there and just lie and lie and lie and try to lie into war. And there's no backlash against them. That's what they call the modified limited hangout. Oh, we're terribly sorry about this Jason Blair scandal. Yeah, it turns out he lied over and over again about nothing important at all. So, you know, crucify him. And that'll make up for us continuing to employ Sanger and Gordon and some of the rest of these guys. I actually like some New York Times reporters. I like Charlie Savage and I like Jim Rison and Eric Lichtblau. They do good work, man. You got to admit it. They got some really bad ones, too. All right. Anyway, all I was really trying to say is I wrote a blog entry, and I did a really lazy, lousy job of it. I mean, I agree with everything I said in it. I just didn't say very much. But I'm going to try to get back in the habit. I promise to get back in the habit of blogging at Stress. That's my blog there at scotthorton.org. So hang around. I'll see you there. All right, good. Brendan O'Neill wrote this thing. And never even mind the major premise. Well, I'll tell you. The major premise is stop gloating, English peace activist types, about what a great job you did defeating David Cameron's plan to attack Syria over the chemical weapons thingamajig. And why should they not be happy about that? Well, for the same reason that Americans really have no right to be proud that our government was able to stop, you know, our will was able to stop our president from doing the same thing. And that is that Britain, and of course America, have been involved in intervening in Syria this whole time. I know he doesn't do the entire history from the First World War on. He's just talking about since the Arab Spring broke out. You see, the deal is this. America controls every dictatorship in the region, less Syria and Iran. So that's why we support every dictatorship in the region, except for in Syria and Iran, where we support the revolution. And now Libya was a special case. That was a situation where America did support the dictator, but only sort of, kind of. We weren't really best friends with him, and Gaddafi had only been brought in from the cold in 2003, and he was expendable. They could make an example out of him, and he was easy enough to kill and overthrow without having to devote too many resources to it. And so they basically figured, for public relations reasons, that Gaddafi was expendable to try to drive home the point that the Americans are on the side of the people, not the dictators in the Middle East. I think they were really worried that it was too obvious, even to the American people, that Uncle Sam is the bad guy here. Mubarak is the dictator of Egypt because Uncle Sam says so. And it's us that the people are in the street overthrowing. And count them, there's 50 million of them or something. They've got the popular sovereignty in their hands, and they're saying they reject ours. And it was just too obvious, even to Americans, that there's no democracy project over there. The project is enslavement. The project is back every king and sultan and emir and so-called president, wink, wink, belly laugh, in the entire region. Other than Syria and Iran, where we want regime change. And so anyway, Gaddafi, and this was in Michael Hastings' great reporting on Libya for Rolling Stone, that Hillary Clinton decided that we've really got to try to get the Arab Spring off on the right foot. In other words, co-opt it, make it our own, and see if we can make some use out of it. So we'll overthrow expendable Gaddafi, pretend like we're on the side of the revolution, and then we can really get to work on our counter-revolution. Supporting the dictatorships clamped down in Bahrain, for example, and in Yemen, for example, and in Saudi Arabia. And then moving on from Libya to Syria, where they can again pretend to support the people against the dictator because they want to control the dictatorship there. And so the thing about that is that, so here's Brendan O'Neill cataloging exactly how America and Britain, he's obviously writing from England, and so he's got a, you know, UK point of view on the thing, but he's talking about America too. And he's saying, step by step, this is how America took what was a region-wide protest movement that was, it was about hungry bellies, but it was also about an end to emergency laws and military rule and torture and jail without trial and all these horrible things in all these countries. And so Brendan O'Neill goes through step by step and explains exactly how America and Britain turned what was a massive peaceful protest movement in Syria, which was making progress at least bringing Assad to the table. I don't know if he had made any real concessions yet, but he was on his way to real compromise there. When the Americans and the Brits intervened over and over, and the French and the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks and the Jordanians intervened over and over and over again to harden the positions of both sides and announcing Assad has no credibility and Assad must go. Now, even this week, there was a headline. That was 2 years ago. And now, even this week, there's a headline. Syrian rebels perfectly happy to meet with the regime for talks in Geneva after Assad resigns. That's been their position this whole time. Because that's what America says their position should be. If it's our position, Assad must go, and we're going to make sure that he goes, then why the hell would they not hang on until we live up to that? Why would they compromise? And of course, and he doesn't have a chance to get into this in this article here, really, but you got to ask yourself, why would anybody support Assad? You know, the Ba'athist tyranny there, it's not quite as bad as Saddam's, I guess, but man, it's a horrible torture police state dictatorship. Brutally lawless and authoritarian, if not totalitarian, probably just totalitarian if you're in its crosshairs, you know? It's horrible. The only reason anybody supports it is because they fear what's coming next more than the horrible dictatorship that they live under now. Because instead of there being a peaceful protest movement of people wanting some serious reforms and some compromises and maybe some elections and maybe some, you know, an independent judiciary and into price inflation, some things that can be reasoned out, people who can, come to reasonable agreements over such issues. Instead, you got the suicide bomber brigades. You got the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, I guess, which is their word for the Levant or whatever, that region there in the Eastern Mediterranean. And the rest of the population of the country is terrified of these guys. So, you know, the push for reform started out pretty broad-based. The push for revolution is not. And in fact, you know, according to numerous different estimates, I believe, I don't think they're all just quoting each other, we've been hearing this for a long, long time, that at least half, maybe more than half, of the fighters on the so-called rebel side in Syria are foreigners. They're not even from there. They're Iraqis and Saudis. There was a report the other day that the Saudis were springing. They were emptying out death row and sending all their criminals on death. Well, and whoever happened to have been convicted and sentenced to death row there in Saudi Arabia, sending all them off to go fight. Just empty your prisons. Perfect opportunity. It's like a replay of the 1980s in Afghanistan. And there have been reports going back for more than a couple of years now, at least, about Afghans and Chechens, and of course Libyans, fighting in the Syrian war. Think about that. Afghan Mujahideen traveling to Syria to fight on the same side as America. Because America is fighting on the same side as them. That's crazy. And Brendan O'Neill, he goes through there and he names all the names and dates and he gets it well. Every time that there was a chance for this to have been avoided, America and Britain's partnership made it worse. Deliberately worse, really. Oh, good. And Brendan O'Neill's going to be on the show tomorrow to talk about this. So, you know, none of this is surprising to you. Cynical power play, this, that, the other thing. It's just, you know, I'm trying to help better inform your opinion for the next time these Republicans and Democrats start crying about how much they care about the people of Syria. If they really cared about the people of Syria rather than getting a regime change for their own selfish interests over the government of Syria, then they could have been promoting peace talks this whole time. Instead, they've promoted suicide bomber Holy Jihad of the Bin Ladenites. And again, why? And you know what? I'm going to ask Stephen Walt what he thinks about this. He's a smart guy. He'll have something to say. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. What are you going to do? How do you avoid it? Israel wanted Assad gone since the start of the Syrian civil war, says Michael Oren, Israeli ambassador to the United States, as he identifies the Tehran-Damascus-Beirut arc, the Shiite axis of evil, as the greatest danger to Israel. And so, where you're scratching a hole in your head trying to figure it out, because you just can't believe that Obama would have, and McCain, that the bipartisan consensus in Washington, D.C., could be that we would side with the Mujahideen. We would side with at least the ideological cousins, the organizational cousins of those who attacked us on September 11th. Well, this is why. Because Israel doesn't like Iran. Say it again because it makes a great footnote. This is what Obama said to Jeffrey Goldberg. Speaking of, you know, agents of a foreign power inside America, Jeffrey Goldberg there at the Atlantic 2 years ago, 3 years ago, asked Barack Obama, hey man, don't you think that pressuring and working against Assad in Syria would be a great way to help limit the power and influence of Iran? And Barack Obama said, yeah, exactly. That's what we're doing. And Jeffrey Goldberg said, can you tell me more about that? And he got all coy and funny and said, oh, well, you know, it's a secret I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. Blah, da, 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 da. Yeah, in other words, America's back on the suicide bombers. Because that's what Benjamin Netanyahu and Jeffrey Goldberg want. It's treason. I mean, I don't know if I should be that hyperbolic. I think I gotta ask. I think it's a fair question to ask a reasonable, moderate, realist gentleman like Stephen Walt, who's coming on the show in just a few minutes. Isn't it treason to provide aid and comfort to those who have sworn allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri? And I know that there's a little bit of gray area there where they swear they're only trying to support the Free Syrian Army, not the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. But even the New York Times and the Washington Post have said all along, that is officialdom, that is quotable when arguing with authority, all along they've said that it doesn't matter because the suicide bomber guys are the ones who end up getting all the money and equipment anyway. Of course, the most extreme are the leaders on the battlefield. Who ever heard of a battlefield led by moderates? Now, American so-called moderates will send extremists off to war, I guess, and call it moderation. But, you know, I don't know how arming the al-Nusra Front through the Free Syrian Army is any more deniable than arming them through the Saudis. When they know that the suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, loyal to Zawahiri brigades are the ones who are getting the money and the weapons. It's treason. It's high treason. In fact, I can't think of another example in American history where the president and the leadership and the Congress were this willing to fight for their enemies. I just can't think of another example. I mean, George W. Bush and his war against Iraq, it was 10 times as beneficial for al-Qaeda as all the support Obama could ever dream to give them in Syria, really. I don't know, maybe not, but the Iraq War was a huge boon to al-Qaeda. Huge. But not deliberately, only because Paul Wolfowitz is really stupid. And the Iranians tricked him into believing that an Iraq war would be good for Israel.
And because he's an idiot, jihadist types ended up becoming the predominant fighters of the Sunni-based insurgency, and yeah. He actually even told Vanity Fair right after the regime change in 03 that one of the reasons we did the war was to get the bases out of Saudi Arabia, because that was one of Osama bin Laden's number one recruitment tools. So you had to get the bases out of Saudi Arabia. So brilliant genius with an IQ of 180-something, Paul Wolfowitz decided, well, we'll just move all those bases north into Iraq, and then our problem will be solved. Never mind that bin Laden's recruitment was against the bases in Saudi Arabia that were stationed there to blockade and bomb the people of Iraq. It's not like there are any holy sites in Iraq that, might offend anyone for being near. And not like spilling blood from Mosul down to Basra for 9 years in a row would bother anybody. But anyway, as beneficial as the Iraq War was for Al-Qaeda, it was only because Paul Wolfowitz is so stupid. Immeasurably wrong. But what Obama and John McCain are doing now is treason. It's directly aiding and comforting the enemy. And I got multiple witnesses to the same overt act, too. I got John McCain over there posing for pictures with the Northern Storm Brigades, who brag that they are veterans of the Iraq War, where they fought against America there. And I don't know why that this one isn't getting picked up all over the place. I should tweet this off to Peter Hart at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and ask him to retweet, man. Somebody pay attention to me, goddammit, when I say John McCain was over there posing with the Northern Storm Brigade. Doesn't matter whether the people in the picture were the kidnappers or not. That group includes the kidnappers, and that group includes people who brag on camera that they are veterans of the Iraq War. Just look at Time Magazine. If you just put in Northern Storm Brigade, the first thing that comes up is Time Magazine. And the guy looking right into the camera saying, yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War. And this is who John McCain's over there palling around with. Because the hoax artist, Elizabeth Obagi, put up to it by Fatneck Fred and his hideous wife, Kim, went over there and arranged this meeting. According to the Daily Caller, John McCain wanted to spend the night. As Dan McAdams put it, he wanted to have a pajama party with these Sunni-based insurgency veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Finally, his security detail put a stop to this thing. That's treason. That's like Benedict Arnold giving over the plans of West Point to the Brits. I mean, what is the mitigating argument? What is the pro-McCain argument at that point? It's treason. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. And tell him Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm your host, him, Scott Horton. Full interview archives are available at scotthorton.org. The new and improved scotthorton.org. Check it out. Almost 3,000 interviews now going back to 2003. And also you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. So please do. All right. So our first guest on the show today is Stephen M. Walt from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's the co-author, of course, of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and he keeps a blog at foreignpolicy.com, and I think I can be, more specific, it's walt.foreignpolicy.com.
foreignpolicy.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing real good, and today's a pretty exciting day. Tell me, what do you think about what's going on at the UN so far?
Well, it's obviously a big event for the American president to be giving his annual address to the opening of the UN General Assembly. But this year, it's been much more exciting than normal because of the possibility of at least some movement between the United States and Iran, in particular in response to the initiatives that the Iranian government has been making ever since their presidential election, and the possibility, in fact, I think now the reality that we're going to see some serious negotiations.
Mm-hmm. So now there were rumors that there was going to be a meeting not just between Kerry and the Iranian foreign minister, but even between Barack Obama and Rouhani. Was that right? Is he in town too?
Yes. The Iranian president will be speaking, I think, later today. I'm not exactly sure what the schedule is. But for the last several weeks, there have been a variety of rumors and a sort of will-they-won't-they conversation about whether or not there would actually be a direct meeting. Would that direct meeting be sort of inadvertent? You know, they bump into each other in the hall. Would it be something more formal? Would it actually be a sit-down? No one has really known about that. And, you know, the fact that we're even obsessing over that question reveals just how large the gulf is between the two countries, that it's such a big deal for the leaders to even have a handshake or even have a conversation is really itself rather symbolic of just how difficult the diplomacy could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading this morning that the Condoleezza Rice, I guess, had talked for just one very brief moment, or maybe not even that, back in the Bush years. Other than that, something like even just John Kerry meeting with their foreign minister. That would be the highest level talk since 1979. I guess the talks over Iraq between Nicholas Burns, whatever, that was the ambassador to Iraq and the Iranian ambassador to Iraq or somebody like that. That's a lower level meeting. And on that much more narrow set of issues there about Iraq and America's relationship with Iran there and that kind of thing. But,
yeah, and my own view is that this is really quite misguided, that we get ourselves in these positions where almost in a childish fit of spite, we decide we're just not going to talk to these people that we don't agree with. And the fact is, you need to be able to have diplomacy even with your adversaries. In fact, it's often more important with your adversaries. We had constant diplomatic contact with the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War, and that was a very good thing. Didn't mean we agreed with them, didn't mean we gave away the store, but the fact that we impose what is essentially an artificial barrier by saying we're not even willing to talk to people is deeply counterproductive. And if you think about sort of the other times when we've done that, you know, we kept communist China in the deep freeze for over 20 years, wouldn't talk to them. We haven't really talked to the Castro regime in Cuba for over 50 years, and that hasn't had any positive effects that I can see. So it would be very nice if we could get conversations with Iran and other countries with which we have disagreements on a more routine basis so we could focus on the substance of our disagreements and not on the atmospherics of, you know, whether or not there's going to be a handshake or not.
Right. Well, now, as you point out on your blog here at foreignpolicy.com, Obama came into power with Iran specifically, not just foreign policy in general, and he wants to be a peacemaker type of a president, kind of a meme, but on Iran specifically, he came into power calling them the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was a seeming kind of, in a way, was saying, we're not going to regime change you. We recognize the legitimacy of your government for the first time this whole time. We want to have talks. He even originally proposed the 20% fuel swap thing before he rejected their acceptance of his offer. So it seems like, well, again, as you say on your blog, the outlines of the deal are obvious here. And really all Obama has to do to be Obama the Great is just live up to what he said he was going to do in the first place. Make peace with Iran.
It's almost that simple, but not quite. I mean, the outlines of a deal are in place, but there are details in any kind of deal that will have to be worked out, and it may be that we can't get a deal that we're happy with. We obviously ought to explore that, and we ought to explore it in a serious way. I mean, I think President Obama, when he came in 2009, did want to try and turn the corner here, but the real pattern of his first term was that any time he faced any serious domestic political opposition, and any time things didn't go his way, he tended to back off. It's also true that the Iranian presidential election of 2009, which obviously was contested and a lot of violence accompanied it, was not helpful at all if you were trying to change the relationship. The optics now, and I think the political realities, are quite different. You have a moderate president in Iran. You have he apparently has gotten the authority from the Supreme Leader Khamenei to do these negotiations. So in a sense, all the stars have lined up about as well as we could hope. And the key question now will be whether or not Rouhani on the Iranian side and Obama on the American side have the political will to push past those who are going to try and oppose this, try to drag out things out, you know, sort of run out the clock, as it will, and not actually make any real progress.
Right. Well, now, obviously, one of the major themes of the war party this whole time has been that, look, these guys are all just obsessed with the 12th Imam coming back and whatever, so... you're not being realistic at all, Mr. Realist, when you say that they're just politicians and they want to maintain their power and that you can deal with them on a human level because they're lost in the world of the supernatural and they're in a sense crazy. They're like David Koresh, right? You can't negotiate that. You just have to burn it. And
yeah.
You know, I wonder whether do you think there's anything to that, or is it, do you think that narrative has finally died with the election of Rouhani?
I think that's nonsense, and it always has been, the idea that Iran is led by a group of irrational mystics who don't look at, you know, interests, don't look at power, don't first and foremost want to keep themselves in power, I think is a sort of desperate argument that's made by people who can't come up with any rational or logical reasons to oppose trying to work things out. I don't want to be overly idealistic here. It's not as though there aren't some real differences, and it's not as though we don't have genuine security concerns with what Iran might do. But that's, again, why you sit down and you try and negotiate a deal that protects our interests as best we can. That's going to involve some hard bargaining. It's probably going to involve some concessions on our part. The United States is not going to get its maximal position. You never do in any serious negotiation. But I think the signs are that we can get a deal here that makes it sensible and rational for Iran to not cross the nuclear threshold. I think that's a deal that's gettable. And we'll see through the negotiating process whether we can get that. If we get that, and then we can start talking with Iran about some other issues where our interests may in fact ultimately align or at least overlap, that would be a huge positive step, and, you know, would ultimately be good for the United States, but also good, I think, for many of our other friends in the region.
Mm-hmm. Well, and after all, they owe us one for overthrowing Saddam for them, right?
Yes, but I don't think they necessarily view it that way. That was certainly not the purpose, right? Remember, back when we were overthrowing Saddam, the idea was, you know, we would do Iraq first, and then we would do Iran and Syria next. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they look back on this as a sign of American benevolence. I think it has been, the whole Iraq episode has been one that has sobered up many Americans about the wisdom of these grand schemes for reordering the entire region. And if that's the case, that's very healthy.
Yeah. Well, now, on the craziness issue, you write on your blog that there are quite a few reasons to believe that the recent Iranian overtures are more than just talk. I forgot exactly how you categorize it, but it's talk where they're basically putting it on the line. They have to follow through with something here.
I mean, the main issue here is that Iran has not just said, you know, gotten up one day and given a speech saying, okay, we'd like to do a deal now. We'd like to come in from the cold, as it were. Ever since the election, there have been a whole series of events that the Iranian leadership have taken, a whole series of steps, you know, releasing some dissidents, saying that the more radical factions of the Revolutionary Guard should stay out of this business for now. And these are things that involve some political cost for Rouhani. They're not just cheap talk. They're involving putting his own reputation on the line. So in a sense, if he makes this overture to us and it goes nowhere, And 6 months from now, the United States is ramping up sanctions and refusing to budge at all on any of its positions. He's going to be dramatically undercut at home. That's, again, not a statement that we're going to be able to work out all our issues. It's just a statement that the Iranians are sincere about wanting to try and work this out, that we shouldn't feel like they're getting ready to, you know, hoodwink us in a big way, or this is all some kind of you know, plot to fool the West into making lots of concessions. I don't think that's true at all.
Mm. Now, don't get me wrong, because I can't imagine that anybody thinks that they have a real plan for carrying this out, but it does seem that the policy on the American side all along has been regime change, hell or high water, someday. Sort of like they passed the Regime Change Act against Iraq in 98, and don't worry, someday our George W. Bush will come and carry this policy through, kind of a thing. And it seems like that is still the policy, is it not? And how are they supposed to deal with us as though we're not crazy?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are clearly American politicians and Americans who think that, you know, overthrowing the clerical regime would be a wonderful thing, and if we could figure out a way to do it, they would love to see us try. I think those people are a remote minority now, and that's a very good thing. Congress has passed various resolutions and has provided money to various Iranian exile groups in the past, which, you know, again, from an Iranian perspective, obviously looks very dangerous. And one thing Americans should remember is we are a much more powerful country than Iran is. You know, Iran's entire defense spending is only about $12 billion a year, whereas we're, you know, upwards of half a trillion. And that should be borne in mind, too. We look a lot scarier to them than they should look to us. So, yes, the Iranians, I think, have reasons to sort of question our sincerity. I think Obama is sincerely interested in a deal. I think he's got lots of support for that now, and I think the American people would support a sensible American negotiating strategy. And as I said a while back, the real question is whether or not Obama now has the political will to really push forward on this, knowing that he's going to face some opposition on Capitol Hill, and knowing that he's going to face a lot of protests from people who haven't wanted the relationship with Iran to improve at all.
Yeah. Now, I got to ask you here, what's the big deal anyway? I mean, I know they declared independence back in 79, and there are a lot of people in D.C. who hold a grudge about that. And I know that Netanyahu and the Likudniks in Israel are terribly paranoid about the existence of any enrichment of any uranium in any way whatsoever, just like in his recent demands. They better suspend everything and export it all, whatever they already have, too, that kind of deal. But is that it? Is that what we're dealing with? An old grudge and the Israelis' paranoia? Or is there something else here that matters that I'm not paying attention to? Oil?
Well, all of those things are important, but there's a couple of other things. It's not just the Israelis who worry about Iran. It's also some of our other friends in the region, like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, who worry about Iranian power over time and don't want Iran to get too big, too influential in the region. So they put pressure on the United States to do something about it as well. Second, we've had, as you said, a troubled relationship with Iran for a long time, and that's true on both sides. Iranian sense that, you know, the United States has been sort of out to get them ever since the 1950s when we sponsored the coup that brought the Shah back, and that ever since the Shah was ousted, we've still been trying to manipulate things. So there's a lot of bad blood and some genuine strategic differences there. That's why this is not going to be an easy process. And as President Obama said in his speech to the UN this morning, one shouldn't expect this all to get resolved overnight, right? There's a lot of mistrust and, as you say, bad blood to work our way through. But the only way to do that is to get started and to deal, I think, initially with the nuclear issue, because that's the most salient one, and then start looking at the other issues as well. There's lots of evidence, by the way, that the Iranian people, and particularly younger Iranians, would like to have a much better relationship with the outside world, including a good relationship with the United States. So there are no, it seems to me, unresolvable or absolute barriers to a very different relationship, and that would be good for us and good for Iran, and I think good ultimately for the region as a whole.
Mm. All right, now, very quickly here, we're almost out of time, but what do you make of John Kerry's efforts on the Palestine issue, the peace talks, as they call them?
Well, I've been skeptical that that was actually going to get anywhere. And again, it will come down, I think, to a question of political will on the Obama administration's side. They pushed hard on this in the first term, briefly, the very first year that President Obama was president, and then when they faced a lot of opposition from the Israel lobby and elsewhere, they backed off very quickly and really never raised it again. The circumstances just don't look particularly propitious for this. We have a quite hardline Israeli government. We have a regional situation that's very much in flux. And there is a point where you sort of have too many issues going on simultaneously. You know, Obama said this morning that he's directing Kerry to negotiate very seriously with the Iranians. There's just going to be a point where Kerry can't keep that many balls in the air simultaneously. So I worry that they have to, or if they're going to have to set some priorities here, as always, the Israel-Palestine issue will be the one that gets kicked down the road again, and it'll be the next president who gets to deal with that, which has been true, of course, for the last five, six, seven, eight presidents.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what do you make of the Leverett's conclusion that what we need here is a real Nixon goes to China and shake hands with Mao kind of moment, because there's always going to be some kind of linkage between this, that, and the other thing that they can come up with over at Commentary Magazine or whatever. And so until we have a real breakthrough on just whether or not we're friends, we're never going to get anywhere on nukes, on Palestine, on anything else.
Well, there's two parts to that. One is I think their idea of a grand bargain with Iran often does make some sense. That it, in other words, you can't deal with all of these issues in isolation. You have to see it as something of a package, even if that package doesn't all get resolved in the same instantaneous negotiation. So the idea that we don't treat this just as getting Iran to give us what we want on the nuclear issue, and then maybe someday we'll talk about their issues, I think that won't work, and one has to think of this in a larger strategic context. Where I'm more skeptical is the idea that, you know, an American president should sort of pull a Sadat and suddenly give a speech saying, I'm prepared to go to Tehran and talk to the Supreme Leader, some big dramatic gesture like that, a sort of Nixon to China thing. We ought to remember that Nixon's trip to China wasn't just something that came out of nowhere. There had been preliminary feelers. Kissinger had gone there secretly. You don't send the president off to negotiate something like that without having worked out in advance that really a deal is going to be had. And therefore, I think the idea of some really bold initiative like that isn't quite realistic. What we should be doing is thinking about the modalities and techniques that can get us to a larger conversation with Iran, but not necessarily with some big initial dramatic presidential announcement.
Right. Okay, well, great. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Very nice talking with you, Scott.
Good to talk to you again, too. That's Stephen M. Walt, everybody. He teaches international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and he blogs at walt.foreignpolicy.com. We'll be right back in a sec. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it, but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. Now, I forgot to ask him about Syria. Well, there wasn't really time. I like that guy, though, Stephen Walt. If you've never read The Israeli Lobby and American Foreign Policy, you should. You know, I think what happened was I never actually finished that book and interviewed him about it. I think I read like two-thirds of the thing, and then something happened. Right? Did I ever interview him about the book itself? I don't think I did. I don't think I've ever talked to Mearsheimer at all. Well, I think Walt's a little bit more accessible than Mearsheimer. But anyway. Good stuff over there at walt.foreignpolicy.com. Coming up, Dan Johnson on the people against the NDAA. Oh, look, he also wrote Taming American Power, Walt did. Who knew? Taming American Power. I like the sound of that. I don't even want to save it up for something big. I just want to not have it.
All right. Well, anyway, so I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. Again, just a few minutes. Dan Johnson will be on the show. I wanted to point y'all to a couple of few things here. I'll try to keep my talking at a minimum and just do more footnote explaining. First of all, our good friend Sheldon Richman's new piece at the Future Freedom Foundation is titled "The Kenyan Massacre's Roots in America's Somalia Policy." And in fact, he quotes my new article at length. My new article is in the subscription version there at fff.org, the Future of Freedom, their journal, their monthly journal. It's in this month's issue. But since you have to be a subscriber, which by all means, subscribe. Help support the FFF for crying out loud. You're talking Hornberger, Bovard, Gregory, Richmond. You got to have these guys working for freedom, man. fff.org/subscribe. And then you get to read the stuff they write, which is the extra super cool bonus. And anyway, so here, I got an article in there for this month. And here Sheldon is quoting it at length and explaining the roots of our problems and, well, the people of Nairobi, Kenya's problems with Al-Shabaab right now. So go and take a look at that. It's a small sample of my work that's in the subscription version of this month's Future Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. And again, it's $25 for the print edition, but it's just $15 a year to read it online. So come on, man. fff.org/subscribe. All right. And then we're just going to... Oh, yeah. A friend posted on my Facebook page a thing at horns.org. That's H-O-R-N-E-S. Somebody's last name, I suppose. It was a good little read here. It's called "How American Christians Get Fooled Into Being Pro-War." I don't usually like to chastise people by sect other than liberal, conservative, left-right type political sects. I don't pick on religious groups necessarily. Unless it's something real specific, like all the polls that said that the more churchy you are, the more likely you are to support torture. Huh? God dang, man. Well, anyway, this guy's got, it's a list of 7 reasons. He says, this is only the beginning. What would you add to the list? It's at horns.org, H-O-R-N-E-S.org. The blog is called "Once More with Feeling." I like that. Like, he's a conductor of an orchestra. Or director of a play or something. All right. How American Christians Get Fooled Into Being Pro-War. And so it's 1 through 7 here. And it mostly has to do with pretending that evil is good. And pretending that good can't be without this evil. And you love the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus, don't you? Well, then that's why we have to kill the Arabs. And they always just find a way to twist it where that sounds like it makes sense. But, of course, it doesn't. Anyway, I really like when I read what seems like Protestant, you know, right-wing Protestant Christians who are really hell-bent against war, you know? Just hardcore about it. Like Lawrence Vance, of course, at LouRockwell.com is the best example. But don't you like that when someone who's like pretty much just a right-wing conservative Christian, when he hates war, hates it? And not just because maybe he was in it and had a really bad time, but for real principled reasons too. Well, I guess you could learn some pretty principled reasons to oppose war by being in one. Anyway, I love that kind of thing. I think it's always really important for the right to attack the right from the right on issues like this. Oh yeah, well, if you're so conservative, how come you're bad on the 8th Amendment? You don't want to conserve the Bill of Rights of George Washington's Constitution, which bans torture? What kind of conservative are you? You sound like some kind of Al Gorean living document type to me, with all your pro-torture policy. Right? Attack the right from the right. And so that's what this guy's doing here. He's saying, you know, all these so-called reasons why right-wing conservative America-loving Christians are manipulated into believing our reasons are good enough excuses for America's warfare state. They don't hold up. It just ain't right. And he goes through them here. I won't do all the debunking, but the topics are God is a warrior, therefore war is good. War is good because we have to defend America. Very vaguely defined, of course. War is right because pacifism is wrong. You got to defend the weak. Without war, there'd be no civilization. We have civilization. We have war. Everybody knows that. God wants us to defend the people again. I should defend my neighbor when he is attacked. So our country should go to war to do the same thing. And also, what about the WMDs? That's just a few. But I think he does a real good job writing about them, too. You know, it's not just what I said. So anyway, it's Mark Horns. Or maybe it's just Horn. He's Horn. And there's no apostrophe S in the URL, of course. Horns with an E. Horns, HORNES.org. How American Christians get fooled into being pro-war. A few ways, for starters. All right, more important stuff here in a minute. Brendan O'Neill tomorrow on the show. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Ingenious, right? All right. Check out the new and improved scotthorton.org. Not .com, that's the newspaper man from Oklahoma. .org, that's me. Almost 3,000 interviews now going back to 2003. And the blog and the chat room and all the rest of it there for you at scotthorton.org. All right. Our next guest on the show today is Dan Johnson from PANDA, People Against the NDAA. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
I'm doing great, Scott. Yourself?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us. And I'm sorry, I think I had it somewhere, but what is exactly your title here at PANDA?
I am the founder and national director of the organization.
National director. Founder and national director. All right, I better write that down so I can say that at the end correctly. Founder and national director. All right, so first and foremost, tell us about the NDAA and spare no expense on detail here.
Sure. So the NDAA itself is usually just a military spending bill. It's been passed for, I believe, 51 years by our Congress and signed by the president every year. However, the NDAA became a very large, very expensive bill, and in doing so, became the perfect haystack to start throwing needles in, especially after 9/11. So in 2007, the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act authorized military units to operate on U.S. soil, only on U.S. soil, and for civil disobedience and crowd control purposes. And then, although that was later repealed in 2009, it set the stage for the 2012 NDAA, which essentially authorizes the indefinite military detention without a charge and without a trial of any person around the world, including an American citizen, who is merely suspected of committing a belligerent act or directly supporting associated forces of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, which, of course, the government can't define, and who is simply accused of it, since they will not get a trial and they will not, odds are they will not even be charged. Also, it allows the application of the laws of war, which is how they justify this. They say America's a battlefield, and it allows the application of the laws of war, which includes torture, which includes execution, which includes rendition to a foreign country, which includes military trials, all to American soil, all to American citizens, violating only a little 14 provisions of our Constitution.
Right. Well, and they've already shown how willing they are to militarize what is essentially a law enforcement issue, as Jacob Hornberger never tires of pointing out. Terrorism's a crime. It's been on the books for a long time. Didn't declare war against even the guys that did it in the case of the Oklahoma bombing. It's prosecuted two of them. You know what I mean? Put them in jail. That's what you do with terrorists. You don't go to war. Uh-huh. Especially not in your own country.
Right, right. And, you know, we've prosecuted over 300 cases of terrorism. Glad you brought that up. We've prosecuted over 300 cases of terrorism through our civilian courts, but we haven't even prosecuted 30 through military courts. And we're saying that these guys should be put under the military's law of war instead of through the civilian courts, which, you know, have actually been doing this.
Right. And, of course, as we know, the vast majority of those in the civilian courts are people who are perfectly innocent, trumped up on some financial charges, or in fact entrapped and goaded by some well-paid government informant into saying something stupid into a microphone or that kind of thing. And they still have no problem convicting them whatsoever. So they really don't need to worry about whether the court system is effective. The federal court system is effective at locking up the people the executive branch wants locked up, you know?
They don't, and which makes it even more concerning that they would take such a step as to give the military jurisdiction over American citizens and over people here on American soil.
All right, now, so hang on a second, because I'm pretty sure I read something at the Daily Coast that said that you must be some kook, because Obama put a signing statement on the thing that says that he never means to apply this to American citizens, and you must have just read that wrong, and you got a J and a I confused or something, because it doesn't say that he can do this to us.
Or as Oklahoma Congressman Lankford put it to a protester, you just got that bill off the internet. No, he would apply it to American citizens, and here's why. In his signing statement, first of all, he said he has the power, but he won't use it. Well, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely, last I checked. And so he's admitting he has the power, and should the executive branch even have that power? I believe constitutionally they should not. And secondly, America leads the country, or leads the world, really, in how many times we've utilized the law of war on our own citizens. In 1862, under Proclamation 94, Abraham Lincoln said, all those who are disloyal to the northern government will be placed under military jurisdiction. And we detained 15,000 northerners, executed several of them, and the Supreme Court said, look, most of those guys were innocent. You shouldn't have done that. Well, we didn't learn our lesson. So in 1942, Franklin Delano Roosevelt passed Executive Order 9066 saying the military shall have jurisdiction over certain areas of the country, and 120,000 Japanese Americans were detained. So to say it couldn't happen here or he wouldn't use it here is to ignore how history repeats itself.
All right, now, am I correct about this, that, and we have the time, if you can, if you need to, and you can, if you have a computer in front of you, and you can actually quote the exact language to prove your point or whatever, we have the time for that. If it comes to that, it's fine with me.
if you can. But I seem to remember reading, and I don't have this in front of me, but I seem to remember reading a Glenn Greenwald article at Salon.com back when this was passed in what would have been late 2011, that said that Obama himself was the one who pushed to make sure, and his allies in the Senate, on his instruction, made sure that the offending language was in there. Because there was actually an outcry in the first place before it was ever even passed. There was a controversy about this, and that it was the White House that made sure that this language stayed. And then only then does he turn around and then he adds this signing statement saying, oh, but don't worry, I promise never to enforce that part of it. So first of all, is that correct? And then can you really show me exactly where it says yes, including Dave and his little sister, if that's what the president wants?
Sure. Let's go into the statements made by Senator Carl Levin on the Senate floor when the NDAA was being passed. He said, quote, "The language which precluded the application of Section 1031, which later became Section 1021 in the final bill, but Section 1031 to American citizens was in the bill that we originally approved in the Armed Services Committee. And the administration asked us to remove the language which says U.S. citizens and lawful residents would not be subject to this section." Close quote. He's right. He received a letter from Defense Secretary Leon Panetta a few days before that, which said, quote, "We recognize your efforts to address some of our objections in Section 1032. However, it continues to be the case advantages that Department of Defense in particular and our national security in general in Section 1032 of requiring that certain individuals be held by the military are at best unclear. This provision restrains the executive branch's options to utilize in a swift and flexible fashion all the counterterrorism tools that are legally available." This is the letter that was sent to Carl Levin from the Obama administration saying that we want you to include American citizens in this language. Now, how are they actually included? Let's go to the actual language of the bill. We're going to assume that this bill, most bills, in fact, it would be right to assume most bills Congress passes affect American citizens. So instead of saying that we need to find somewhere where it shows it affects American citizens, that should be an automatic assumption. Congress passes a bill, it affects American citizens. We make bills, make laws for our country, usually, not the rest of the world. And so where I want to point out is where they tried to take Americans, or supposedly try to take American citizens out. Under Section 1021, Section 1021, 1022. I've got actually, okay, wrong page. 1022 D1. The requirement to detain a person in military custody under this section does not extend to citizens of the United States. Well, that's interesting, because it seems at first glance that, you know, the requirement to detain doesn't extend, you know, that we're not affected by this bill. However, what does it say? The requirement to detain. If they wanted American citizens to be excluded, they would have said, just literally said, this doesn't apply to American citizens. But they said the requirement to detain does not extend. You remove the requirement, what do you have left? An option.
Right.
And so the fact that they put this language in the bill, the fact they put this language in here, says that it does apply to American citizens, and the fact that this doesn't exclude them further proves it applies to American citizens.
Boy, it sure sounds like it to me. Read 'em and weep, everybody. That's how they get you. And you know what? Ever since my very first vote, when I voted against George W. Bush when I was a kid, I remember reading all the double talk in the bond issues, all the yes or no's, where yes means no and no means yes. And I guess really no means yes more than anything. You got to be careful. These lawyers and their legalese, they'll get you. But it sure sounds like you've got the discrepancy sure ironed out there. Unfortunately,
I mean, it is unfortunate, and the main point about this, and Judge Catherine Forrest of the Fourth District Court of New York said this very clearly. It's like, look, the NDAA and the 2012 NDAA section, the detention provisions, the covered persons are too vague, and when indefinite detention, possible indefinite military detention, is on the line, You cannot have a bill with such vague language.
Right. Well, and, you know, I was going to say, because, you know, and please talk about the Associated Forces, and there's a whole lawsuit going on just on, I think, on those grounds, the Associated Forces ground, the Ellsberg thing. But I just wanted to remark real quick about, you know, what they consider war crimes if we use Guantanamo Bay as an example of their military justice. They've abandoned the old traditional military court-martial system for this kind of thing, and it's all ad hoc since now, I guess, the Military Commissions Act of 2009 version of how to do this stuff. But the convictions for war crimes that they've gotten so far have been against an innocent kid, against a cook, and bin Laden's driver. And this is what they call, you know, they just stretch material support for terrorism, which doesn't really mean anything. Hell, if it doesn't apply to John McCain, but it does apply to Omar Khadr, then there's no definition at all. And then they call it not just a crime, but it's a war crime. And so we already see the angle that they have on this. It's sort of like if they want to get you for mail fraud, they'll get you just for checking the mail. They don't, you know what I mean? They'll get you for anything.
They will. And when you give the, I saw a great quote one time, and it said, when you give someone an inch, they'll think they're a ruler. And it really brings home the fact that you cannot give government even the legal authority, even, and to say they'll never use it, I think is fallacy, but let's say you think they'll never use it. You cannot give them the legal authority. You don't want to ever give them legal authority to violate your rights. That is not, they don't care about you. That's the best way to say it, is they don't follow the rule of law in the first place. And when you put a law in place that condones their actions, because, for example, Anwar al-Awlaki and his son, Abdurrahman al-Awlaki, killed 2 weeks apart in two separate drone strikes in Yemen, both American citizens, were killed because the president claimed he had the authority to do so. Nothing else. The president claimed he had the authority to kill them, and then he just did. The NDAA then goes and says, yeah, you had that authority. Here's your legal backing for that. So it's kind of, they're attempting to go back in time with this and justify it.
Mm-hmm. Like, and they did with the NSA wiretapping of the Bush era with their FISA Amendments Act. They just legalize it after the fact.
An ex post facto law, which last I checked was illegal, so according to our Constitution.
Yep. Well, the thing is not self-enforcing. There's no teeth in any of that. It's up to us. And
exactly.
And listen, so this gets us to the real point, which is your organization and what you're doing about it. And the answer is something is actually happening. You are doing something about it. Please go on at length.
Sure. I founded PANDA, People Against the NDAA, on January 29, 2012, with a couple of the college students. And we, the next month, went to our city council and tried to get them to say no to this. I figured it was a no-brainer. The military is claiming they could possibly indefinitely detain someone. It's a no-brainer for you just to pass something that says, no, they won't do it here. But the response we got back was students should have taken, you should basically go back to basic government class, was the thing I got from my mayor. And the thing I got from my city council was, how would you do something you can actually have an effect on? In that type of condescending tone. And so you have a choice. You can choose to give up at that point because they didn't pass it. And, you know, I'd tried. Or you can choose to say, you know what? You're the people who I'm going to prove wrong. And I chose option B. So PANDA has, since that point, become the largest organization, the leading organization in the country fighting the NDAA. We have about a little over 30 state teams nationwide. We have introduced probably about 20 pieces of legislation in different states. And we currently have active legislation in Albany, New York, and in a couple other counties. And we're going at a local level, because imagine government corruption as a pyramid. At the top, all the money. whoever's controlling the money at the top, you can call them the banking cartel, you can call them the syndicate, whatever. And then below them, you have the federal government, you have the executive, legislative, judicial. Below them, you have the states. And below them, you have the city and local government. And then you have the street level bureaucrats just below them. Well, if you're going to effect real change, don't go to the top of the pyramid and knock the top off. Somebody will walk up that pyramid of corruption and place a new top on. That's what happened in Egypt. Notice Egypt has had massive, massive protesting in the streets twice. And where are they today? They still are under military control, and the military is going out, and they're going to war, essentially, with Morsi supporters. Not to say either side's right, but they didn't win. They didn't get the change they wanted. And so in America, if we're going to have the change we wanted, we need to start at the bottom. We need to pull brick by brick by brick by brick out from under this pyramid until we reach 51%, and then it falls. And then the center of gravity loses its center of gravity. And so you can bring real change at a level, and not only that, at a level you can actually affect. You sending a letter to your congressman, I'm sorry, it doesn't work. They don't listen. You sending a letter to your state representative, much better. You going into your city council and telling your city council how you want that city to run, that matters. That really matters. And so we're going in a city level, we're going at a county level, we're going somewhat at the state level to stop this egregious piece of legislation from ever being enforced, first with law, second with enforcement, telling them about the law, and finally, we the people are the final bastion. We must stand, and we must stay in the area and watch them and make sure they keep their oath.
Right. Well, and see, this is the thing. It's sort of just like with the shouting down of the war on Syria 2 weeks ago. It is really a case study, really interesting to see the politicians. Most of them, they're not very deep individuals. They're ambitious, but that's about it. And you get them in a situation where their phone is literally ringing off the hook, and everybody on the other line is determined and opposed to the terrible thing they're trying to do. That can really make a big impression on them. That, like, wow. I mean, then again, the leadership told them, hey, it's a conscience vote. Go ahead, and you don't have to vote for it if you don't want to, kind of thing. And maybe it would have been a bit different if they'd played it a bit different. But, it's not nothing, the fact that all these guys went to all their town hall meetings and all their staff told them that every email is opposed here. And it's just the consensus of the people is no, we don't want to. And it could be that very same no consensus on, come on, issues like the NDAA. I mean, if we can't all come together and agree on that, assuming we're informed on what the issue is, if we can't all agree on that, we ought to just hang it up and just call ourselves Canadians or something. But
at this point, I mean, really, the NDAA, although it is a tyrannical piece of legislation, it's almost been a godsend because it is an issue that affects every person who's politically active, regardless of what party you are. And regardless of what party you are, your elected leaders voted this in 93-7 in the Senate. So it's us versus them. It's we the people versus the political, I'll call them the political class. And so it's really been a godsend because we need to unite. There aren't enough people on the right or on the left to fix this problem. We have to unite and say enough. We've had enough of this. And that's the way we're going to really bring our country back to the principles that it was founded on and to a real government which was instituted to protect our rights, bringing it back to that point.
Yeah. And this is the whole thing, and this is really why I keep doing this, is because I am, despite everything, I am still hopeful that we really do have a consensus, again, among the people, not those with power, but among the people, that the system, even though it'll never be great and perfect or whatever, it's supposed to work toward making sure the trials are fair. We're making sure that, if we send our guys off to war, it was only because we really had to. And, some of these just very kind of basic assumptions about what's right and how things are supposed to work around here. I think, Americans generally agree about all that. And if we can put it in, a bit more specific terms, like what we need is peace, to abandon our empire
and to reinstate the Bill of Rights before we never have any more of it ever again, I think that we can rally people around that. I think that even if people don't know what's in the Bill of Rights, they know they like it. And if you tell them what's in it, they go, yeah, that's right, that's right. I like that. You know what I mean? The ban on torture, the promise of a lawyer, and an actual chance at proving your innocence, if not, you know, at least just having to cast doubt on your guilt. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And it's really our fault, which means it's our responsibility, which also means we can fix it. It's your responsibility. You can fix it. And it's we the people's fault. We the people have let this down. It's not the politicians eventually have to eventually answer to us. And so it's we the people who have fallen asleep at the wheel. And if we the people go back at it because it's our fault in the first place, we can fix it.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, what goes on, too, is we get accustomed to things. It's hard to go back to the mentality. Remember back the mentality of 2002, 2003, when everybody's still in the middle of reacting. But, you know, it doesn't take too much imagination to think of somebody putting a nuke in one of our harbors, blowing up one of our, you know, harbor cities on the East or West Coast or the Gulf Coast or something. And what the reaction might be then, oh, everything changed on December 13th when the nuke went off. And then, you know, probably wouldn't be Dan Johnson or Scott Horton who were first to go to the camp, although we may have been sticking our neck out a little bit far on this one. But no, most likely it would be American Muslims and immigrants and people who have not even a semblance of political power who would be rounded up, would be the victims of this. And it's a very real possibility. You know, like you were saying, it's hard to invoke the Civil War so long ago, it's almost a fairy tale or something, but just, you know, like World War II and the Japanese internment, or even just the way that John Ashcroft rounded up thousands of people under the pretext of a material witness warrant after September 11th. That could have gone really bad right there. You know what I mean? It could have kept exactly. All those guys.
You know, your principles are not tested in average times. Your principles are tested in crisis. The reason our government was founded is to protect our rights. And if they won't even, if they consider a crisis, the reason they need to get rid of our rights, we need to get rid of the people in our government.
Yep. Hey, we lost about 20% of your phone quality there, I think, Dan. Something happened?
Still here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound much better now.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure what's the problem. In fact, if you want, you go ahead and repeat that, because I didn't really hear you.
Okay. I said, if the government, you know, your principles are tested in times of crisis, not in times in your average, your normal day. Mm-hmm. Your principles are tested in times of crisis. And if our government gives up its principles in times of crisis, we need to get rid of the people in our government.
Yeah, well, I sure appreciate this. And now, can you tell us again, how many states was it that you said where you guys have, I don't know, was it legislation introduced or at least an activist group working on it or what?
We had introduced legislation in over 20 states. It's somewhere between 20 and 22. And the very fact that it's being introduced is what's amazing here.
Yeah, that is huge. That is really a big deal. See,
yeah,
again,
yeah.
That alone is just a huge PR stunt toward building a real consensus, building awareness of the issue and a real consensus about it. I mean, wow, you're really doing good work there. I had missed that when you said 20 before. That's great.
I wouldn't necessarily say a PR stunt so much as it's educating the legislators on the issue. It's teaching them that this is the time they need to say we've had enough and interpose against a rogue federal government. So, but so it's not a PR stunt. But what it is this type of legislation has not been introduced, to my knowledge, since segregation period. That's been a long time. That's been a very long time, and it was used for evil back then. But today, it can be used for good. And we haven't the states, the counties, cities haven't done this in a long, long time. So to see this standing up, to see this them saying enough, that's important.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's the thing, too, is more and more as the 10th Amendment Center guys like to point out, You have issues that are, you know, so-called left-right type issues, like drugs here, guns there, NDAA all around, where there's plenty going on in D.C. for all sides to be sick and tired of their tyranny and for this kind of interposition. So we're all out of time, but thank you again for your time on the show today, Dan, and best of luck to you. This is great work, and I hope people will help support. Again, the website here is PandaUnite.org, and that's Dan Johnson, founder and national director. Appreciate it. And that's it for the show today. Panda, People Against the NDAA. Check that out. Again, I'm Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org is the website. We'll be back here tomorrow, 11 to 1 Eastern time. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly.